Hi, this is Dr. Kimberly Leonard, and you're listening to Incredible Life Creator Podcast. My guest today is Jacob Aldridge. Jacob Aldridge lives the life you might wish you had. As an international business advisor and keynote speaker, Jacob delivers results on the ground and remotely for companies in Asia Pacific, Europe, and North America. As budding perpetual travelers, Jacob and his beautiful wife have been around the world twice. And even their young daughter visited 19 countries before her first birthday coincided with the global changes of March 2020. Currently trapped in an Australian paradise, Jacob is a Guinness World Record holder, TV and podcast host, and best-selling author who has just published his sixth book on visionary male leaders. He credits his outrageous success on one key principle: ignoring the experts that told him to specialize. Welcome to the podcast, Jacob.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, and we're just talking about the challenges of family life before we came on, and that you have a toddler running around. So if the toddler runs around or decides to come and sit on your lap, we'll just say hi to them, and then we'll get about
it. We'll welcome baby Flash to the conversation. She's got a lot of wisdom to add, as we all know when we listen to the younger generation.
That's right. That's right. So just so people can get to know who you are, tell us your story.
In 25 words or less. Well, thank you for that lovely introduction that certainly touched on a lot of the points. And I feel when I've shared my story, I had a lot of people that come up and talk to me afterwards who had a similar challenges, similar experiences. So I left school. In my case, I did go and do some higher education. It was fun and a lot of partying. And in terms of career and purpose, I really struggled, not because I didn't have options, because in many ways I had too many. I had too many interests. I had too many opportunities. And when you're faced with that breadth of decision-making, especially as a young person who doesn't have a whole lot of context and experience to draw on, it can be really challenging. And so I did struggle through the first number of years of my career doing a lot of different things that interested me. And it was the intersection of training and sales and accounting and strategy and culture and all of these fascinating topics. But most businesses, at least back then, 15, 20 years ago, weren't looking for someone who had a range of skills. They were looking for someone who was really good at one thing, one or two things, that they could put them in a box and say, well, you fit this position description. And that just wasn't me. And I got very lucky replying to a job ad out of a newspaper from a business that actually had, in many ways, the opposite problem to me. I had this range of different skills. I wasn't an expert on any of them, but I knew a lot about a lot. I was young. I thought I knew a lot about a lot. And they were looking for someone who also had that breadth of skills, and they were struggling to find someone because they were a big franchise group. They had about 80 franchisees. So they needed someone who the franchise owner could call to talk about accounting one moment and then strategy or HR the next. They weren't a big enough organization to have a team of experts. And so that was fantastic. And that was an opportunity for me to realize that having that breadth of skills was actually really valuable, particularly to business owners who are generally very good at one thing, but are being called on in all of these different areas. And that was really the catapult for my career. I then was able to focus on training more depth and more knowledge into that range, and going out in 2006 as a business advisor, going out to all those, mostly 10 to 100 staff businesses where there's a lot of pressure on the owner. They need someone they can trust and support, and that was me. And then having done that, having realized I could take all this value out into the world, there was nothing stopping me from taking myself and now my family out into the world as well, which is what we've been doing on and off for the best part of the last decade.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds wonderful, and it's a dream for so many people. Oh, one day I'll travel the world. And how many of us actually get out there and do it? Life starts and we kind of get stuck in one place,
and we get on this conveyor belt, career or the family or the mortgage or and someday, one day. My focus was always, well, if I want it, what can I do? What if? Great framework one of my coaches taught me was permission, listen, choose. Give yourself permission to do anything, be anything, eat anything, wherever some of those blocks are, have permission to do everything, to overcome some of those limiting beliefs, and then listen to your soul about what it is that you truly want to do, and then make a choice. And it's not the easiest choice. I would certainly be wealthier if I was more focused on that than some of these other choices. Having the option to do anything in the world, I went, well, how do I make my business remote and online? And back then, people thought that was a little bit crazy, a little bit ridiculous. And then we all see what's happened in the last 18 months, and suddenly everybody's an expert in online work.
Mm-hmm. That's true. So I heard what you said, the coach said, but how did you change that mindset to be able to actually take that first step, to go to that first place?
The biggest thing for me was not feeling like I had to do it immediately. I think that's always the challenge. When you get excited about something new, or you get really passionate, you get some awareness that, hey, there are other people out there who are living that dream, or they're working remotely and traveling, or they're having families, they're making money, whatever it is that might be your passion. It's very easy to get caught up in, how do I make that happen immediately? And then if it doesn't happen for me immediately, you start to get a bit despondent. Maybe you start having some of those, you know, cognitive biases around, well, I didn't really want that anyway, or maybe that's not for me. So a good thing for me, I suppose, is that I've always had this ability to be calm about living for the future, and not necessarily 20 years' time. It's just by making a decision now to take my business completely online and remote. And the first time I did that was February 2009. My beautiful wife and I sat down and said, okay, we want to go and base ourselves out of the United Kingdom, where I'm a citizen, and travel a lot around that part of the world, use that as a springboard. We don't want to just roll on up to Heathrow Airport and have to try and find jobs. So let's give ourselves time to make my work remote. And that took 6 months in 2009 for me to get some clients, convince them that this sort of technology works and was reliable, and that I was just as available on the other side of the world as I was the other side of a city here in Australia. And by having that time and losing the pressure that it had to happen immediately, we could do it well and do it properly. And we made mistakes and learnt a lot, and it keeps evolving and improving. I think that was probably the biggest thing for me, was not feeling I had to rush into it, taking the time to plan it and then execute upon that plan.
Mm-hmm. And being remote now, how is it that you actually find your clients?
Thankfully, I'm fairly lucky in that 15 years on, most of my current clients in the advisory space are repeat and referral businesses. There's three aspects to my business these days. There's that implementation, actually helping business owners make change in their business. There's a bit more of the impact, which is the keynote speaking. It's the authorship. It's getting the message out in front of 100 people, 1,000 people at a time, knowing not everyone's ready for it right now, mm-hmm. and hoping to make an impact on the few that are. And then there's investing. So implementation, impact, and investing. So I'm an investor in a small number of startup businesses or young businesses that I hope will have great potential to make some change in the world for various purposes across those businesses. So make sure I've got enough time. So the advisory work is now not taking up as much as it used to, which means I don't need as many clients. In the early days, particularly being remote, it was very much around having a presence, being abundant, transparent. I'm on a lot of different social media channels under my real name. Mm-hmm. I don't try and hide who I am. I bring all of who I am to every conversation. And that tends to get people who watch an interview that I do or read a post that I make, sign up to a newsletter, see some of my videos, all of those things. They reach out when the time is right. And that consistency of activity is where I see a lot of smaller businesses, consultants, freelancers fall down. They do it for a little while and it either doesn't work, so they stop, or it does work and they get too busy and so they stop. So you've got to be consistent. And then you've got to ask. And that's harder for some people than others. It wasn't my natural place. When you get an opportunity, when you get into an interesting conversation with somebody, it's asking, what do you need right now? How can I help you? Which might be an introduction, It's not a sales conversation. How can I help you? And then who do you know that I should be talking to? And it's amazing what conversations that opens up that a lot of people don't have because they just don't ask the question.
Exactly. Yeah. And as you're talking, you know, the authenticity part is so important because there's just so much out there and people have seen enough where they know when people are being authentic and when they're not. And then when you come and you actually sincerely ask, how can I help you? Most people are going to respond to that, but they also respond when you say, hey, can you help me with something? Which is really important.
That help word is so critical. And you see it through a number of the conversations that I've watched you have over the time, how often that comes up with people who are, they're looking to help, and we have businesses around helping people. It's not wholly 100% from the altruistic giving it away. We got to, you know, feed the children, our children. But it's that authentic, how can I help? Can you help me? And I think humans on a level really respond to that. And it's amazing how you can create relationships by talking about help or by asking for help in a way that you're never going to do if you're trying to push another agenda.
That is so true. And just having those conversations, because with people, you know, feeling a little isolated, the more you can have the conversations, the better. And it's amazing how you can make friends across the world. I mean, I had somebody on my podcast and she somehow on Twitter made with a friend across the world in South Africa. And they become such good friends that she'll rent a movie and they'll put the movie on Zoom and watch it together. That is so wild.
You know? Oh, that is brilliant. That is brilliant. As a movie lover, I love that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember going to a conference in 2019, so the before times, and it was amazing going into this room. We were in Toronto in Canada, which was the first time I'd been to the Great White North. And it was almost sort of lunchtime on day one that a few of us sort of realized that we'd never actually met in person before. Mm-hmm. We knew each other so well. We had known each other online and through Zoom calls and emails and chats, all of those things, that it really didn't occur to us that we'd never actually met, that this was a different type of relationship. And what's really fascinating, I've just had a few days at a conference here in Australia called Something Digital, which is talking about a lot of the bigger impacts of the digital world. And there was a fascinating speaker who talked about, you know, people my generation who have an identity in meat space, you know, the physical world, and how for a lot of younger people, their digital identity, their virtual identity, their social media identity is a core part of who they are. When you take their device away, you're taking away part of their identity, which I'd never quite realized before. And there's a learning there for me as a parent, and also a realization that, yeah, maybe I have some limiting beliefs around how this has to happen in person, because I can have amazing conversations with people all around the world and not have to coordinate plane flights to do it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, I wanted to talk about the book that, is it out now or is it coming
out? It is. It's been out only for a little while now. My latest one, I can wave the cover. For those who are watching along, Visionary Male Leaders. Yes, so thank you for bringing it up. It's I tend to bring it up in a lot of conversations, but it's always nice when somebody else asks me first.
So yeah, so tell us about the book, because I kind of was reading a little bit of the summary, but I'd like to hear it from you.
Sure. This is a topic that I've been quite passionate about, and some of that speaking, that impact work for a number of years now, which is embracing the feminine energy, feminine leadership traits in order to improve your business. And that can often be a little bit controversial, partly because I'm not a woman. I'm not even a particularly feminine energy man. We all have both, right? We all have some feminine energy. We all have some masculine energy. Some of us just lean more strongly in one direction. I'm very much a masculine energy person. And I learned the hard way through my career that that what therefore works for me as a leader, as a business owner, doesn't necessarily work for my leadership team, my partners, my employees, my clients. And that led me to learn a lot more about the feminine energy, much more nurturing, supportive, present oriented. I get up on stage and talk about that. And you can tell for the first 5 minutes that a lot of the people in the crowd are thinking, why is this man getting up to mansplain womanhood to me? Until I start to unpack some of those. And the opportunity with Visionary Male Leaders, the book, was to work with 14 other men who are having that conversation in their organizations or in, as advisors like I am in with their clients. And our incredible editor, Sarah Bellarini, she saw the opportunity to really lean into that, that this was a book by men about the feminine energy, which is not just women. It's something that impacts all of us. And by having 15 men writing about it, her hope was that it opened up that conversation to a whole lot of other people who otherwise might not be interested. Those male leaders who intentionally or not, consciously or not, still only listen to other men giving them advice. Here's an opportunity to do that. And certainly to create cut through so that people might do a double take and think, well, hang on, why are men talking about this? Because I don't think there's a lot new in there that a lot of strong women haven't been talking about. Mm-hmm. It's just a different perspective on the challenges as a man to understand and embrace that as a leader. And it has been very, very well received.
Mm-hmm. And how does a man implement that into his life or take on some of those personality, I don't know if it's a personality or energy?
Yeah. A lot of it comes, first of all, to that self-awareness. And it's the reason I love it. I see that there is this challenge of, you know, women in leadership positions, women fulfilling their desires, their purpose, their passion. And I think some of it sits behind it, which isn't the gender, it's this energy. And we all have both. And I think that's the first thing for a male leader to appreciate is, even if it's only a small part of what it is that they're doing, or how it is that they feel, how it is that they respond, there is absolutely part of them that is grounded in the present, that is nurturing, that is looking for connection. And if they can tap into that part of themselves, then they are a better place to empathize with people who have a stronger feminine energy, which may be the women in their leadership team, it may be some of the men in their leadership team. And then they can start having the conversation. And part of that being in connection, being in relationship, and frankly, part of building trust in a team is the vulnerability. And it's for men, women who are more masculine perhaps as well, or have been told that's how you have to behave, to put your hand up and say, I'm learning this. It's not my natural space. Mm-hmm. However, I want to learn more. I want to do more. And I want to have these conversations. And just like that help piece, if you're a leader in a business and you say, I want your help with this, the responses you're going to get are not people throwing criticism or rotten tomatoes at you. They're people who will meet you with that help when it's genuine and want to support that conversation. And my chapter on the book is focused on the practical. That's what I like to do, is get stuff done in business. And I knew that some of my other authors were very much leadership coaches, energy coaches. They were talking the big picture. I wanted to focus on the practical, and there are specific things you can do to implement more feminine energy systems in your business. It starts from being in touch with your own feminine energy and recognizing your weaknesses or lack of understanding about that.
Mm-hmm. And as far as just increasing business or maybe enhancing the relationships with your clients, how does that feminine energy affect a business?
The commercial outcomes are extraordinary. And I think if you take an analogy away from the masculine and feminine that might be a little confusing to people who haven't seen that, or a little bit confronting for people who maybe have some assumptions about it. You know, if you were an American company and you decided to start selling to Germany, which is an incredible market, big country, that's going to come with some challenges. You're going to potentially have some language challenges, although I guarantee you the average German speaks a lot more English than the average American speaks German, or me. It's a language I struggle to learn German, no matter how many times I've been there. You're going to get some cultural differences. You're going to get some things that are nuanced and unclear and you may be unfamiliar with. And you can try and do the thing of just pushing what worked at home. This is how we sell it in America. Therefore, this is how people are going to buy it in Germany. Or you can take the time to reach out to German partners, potential German clients or customers, and say, help me understand, what is the need that my service is helping with, and how would you articulate it? How would you explain it? How would you market it, sell it, use it, all of those things? Learn those differences and be open to having some of your assumptions challenged. And if I said that to a business, you're expanding into another country, you need to learn the nuances of that country, all of the board, however pale, male and stale they may or may not be, they would sit there, oh, of course, Jacob, you're a very smart man. Of course, we need to learn German. Mm-hmm. I sit there and say, you have a whole lot of clients and customers that are primarily feminine energy. Maybe you need to apply the same thing. Can't get more pushback. Once they understand that analogy, though, start to say, oh, wow, so there's this whole 50%+ of the world are women. Maybe if we understood what motivated a lot of them, we might get more commercial outcomes. And hey, culturally, maybe we would actually have an organization internally that we took out to the world that was a lot more supportive of those people as well.
Beautiful. And just more of a personal question. So you delving into this pretty deeply and talking about it with other businessmen, has that had an effect on your relationship with your wife?
Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt. And I talk when I deliver these presentations at big conferences as part of trying to overcome some of those hurdles or assumptions that people might make. I talk about the fact that I am not naturally in the feminine energy space. I am traditionally the masculine, future-oriented, what's the outcome we're looking for? What's the solution to this conversation, which has a place in business and in life. And so I made the mistake as a young man. I was married to my beautiful wife in my 20s. I made the mistake of assuming that my experience of the world was most people's experience of the world, which is a classic thing that I think we all do. And it helps in some cases, but it really sets up blind spots that I sort of thought, well, I'm happy, I'm successful. Maybe if more people were like me. Mm-hmm. And that created friction in any relationship, especially that intimate relationship. And it's not about me then needing to be the feminine energy space. It's about me understanding that, understanding where she might be coming from in a conversation or a relationship or a reaction. Mm-hmm. And it's also us together, and we've done a lot of work together as well, which I highly recommend. Obviously, tell boards, work with advisors, couples, absolutely. And it's not a sign of weakness, it's a sign of strength. Just like in business, getting that advice is a sign of strength. Mm-hmm. Understanding the complementary nature, and that's the beauty of the masculine feminine conversation, is that it's not about both of us need to be in one space or the other. We understand each other, that advances our relationship. And then if we can lean into our strengths on either side, that actually balances and makes it a lot more complementary. And that's one of the great joys, that what I really want to do as masculine, mm-hmm. what my beautiful wife really wants to do as a feminine, massively complementary, even if they differ. And having that awareness has certainly strengthened our relationship and our life in business and travel.
Yeah, beautiful. So I want to switch over to Guinness World Book of Records. There's got to be a story behind that.
there is. It's a wonderful story that and perhaps is a classic example of the masculine. I want to be the biggest. I want to be the best. I want to. How do I do it? I think that's maybe one of those dreams that I won't make assumptions about other people. It's something that I and many of my friends dreamt of as a little boy. You get given, or you read in the library, the Guinness Book of World Records. You think, how do I get myself in there? Mm-hmm. And I was on a holiday with one of my friends and the new book had come out. We were looking for some books to read. This was before smartphones and all of those sort of things. And the new book had come out, I was flicking through it, and there was a record in there for the world's longest movie marathon. And I thought to myself, I can watch a lot of movies. That pretty much got me through my university days, which is binge-watching films while doing assignments. And the world record at that time, that was 2002, was only about 24 hours. It was a fairly new record. And so we thought we could do that. We could beat that. And we wrote off to the Guinness Book in Ireland, and they sent back this long list of criteria that you had to follow, very, very strict rules. And the record had been broken a few times since then, and it stood at 59 and a half hours for nonstop movies. So we ticking all the rules, all the plans. It had to be in a public place. So we had a cafe open up and put up the projector screen and all of these things. And we broke the record. We watched movies nonstop, no sleep, for 63 and a half hours, which for a bit of context, we started at 9 a.m. on a Saturday. All the Saturday, all the Sunday, all the Monday, we stopped watching at 1:30 a.m. on Tuesday morning. And throughout that all, sitting there watching the screen, we were allowed a stretch and bathroom break after every third movie. So it was pretty strict. And I like to say they've made the rules a lot easier now. There's a lot more sleep and bathroom breaks now. So the record's been broken by people who didn't have to do it as hard as we did back in my day.
Right. I can't imagine staying awake that long. That's a long time to stay awake.
It was. And you start to really learn a lot of interesting things about your body when you're in that real severe sleep deprivation state, around how you respond, in relationship to all the witnesses and the medical professionals that are around, and how you can push yourself through it without a whole lot of stimulation. You're only allowed to go to the bathroom after every third movie. So it's not like we were throwing back a whole lot of coffees or Red Bulls. We very much had to be, well, maybe not peak physical condition. This guy wasn't Eliud Kipchoge running a marathon in under 2 hours, but I did have to learn a lot about my body to get through it and to now have that to draw on in a range of different, you know, when I talk to businesses about strategy, it's got the goal. How do you actually go and do it? And then doing it. And then when I find myself as a parent, sleep deprivation, I can always sit there and go, well, at least I slept 2 days ago. I know I've been through worse than this.
That's true. But let's just talk about finishing the course, because so many, especially business owners, they have this great idea. They're excited. They get started. And then you see the stats, you know, 3 years or less, they're not even there anymore. So how do they get in there, actually be sustainable and actually finish, actually get to the point where they're making money and enjoying their business?
And I certainly resonate with that. My current context for my business right now is just say no, because I've said yes to so many things this year, like writing another book, doing all these. I need to just finish more of them before I can add more. And I think that follow the bouncing ball, follow the shiny object. If you've seen Up, the Pixar Disney film where the dogs and the squirrels, squirrel, squirrel, squirrel. I think a lot of business owners, entrepreneurs are quite like that. The next squirrel that comes along distracts them, drags their attention. The early days of business are overwhelming. I wrote a book in conjunction with another business advisor a few years ago on the 50 first steps that successful entrepreneurs take in their first year. So it was the startup business guide was what we called it. And the very, very first chapter, I said that going into business is like swimming or sex. That you can't learn this experience from a book. You can maybe get some guidance, some understanding of how to swim from a book, but you've got to jump into the pool and hope that you've got some protection. And I think business is the same. It's only really once you jump in that you learn. That overwhelming. And, you know, there's a couple of things. You've got to get the product market fit. You've got to learn some sales skills, make sure the business model actually works so that if you win some clients or some work, it's, you know, at least revenue generating on the other side, hopefully profitable, so you can get that cycle going. And you've got to do a lot more talking to customers than I think most business owners realize, because they think they've got a great product and therefore people will come. Build a bigger mousetrap. Nobody's knocking on your door if they don't know about it. And so doing that activity, overcoming the assumptions and learning the personal energy management of how you get through that overwhelm, that anxiousness, that uncertainty of a startup is critical. And there's one thing I like to point out, which I completely stole from another business advisor, Anna Wickham in Oklahoma City, as it is. But it was just such a perspective shift for me on that, you know, how many businesses don't survive. And the statistics here in Australia, where I've been involved in some research with some of the bigger accounting firms, half of all businesses are gone within 3 years. And, as you go further out, 5 years, 10 years, that the number is even smaller. But just because the business has failed doesn't mean the business owner has failed. The business owner is then in a position to say, well, that didn't work. Here's what I learned. What can I do differently next time? And that is often one of the hardest decisions that a business owner can make, is to actually, in the words of Faulkner, kill my darlings, close the business, say, okay, that didn't work, and yet have the energy, the strength, the courage to go and try it again with something different. And there are very, very few successful business owners and entrepreneurs who have always been successful. And that's one of the frustrations when you talk to successful, you see them at a conference, you listen to them on a podcast and they talk about the success and you're not experiencing that. You realize that they probably had a lot of failures, a lot of mistakes along the way. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that you're having those as well doesn't mean that your situation is hopeless, and don't get despondent about that, because you can persevere as an individual and hopefully with the current business idea you've got as well. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you said that you have invested in some companies that are just starting out, if they look like they're going to do things to change the world, make things better. So if you have, let's say, a young person or any person, they're like, okay, I want to start my first business, but they have no money. You know, they say they're just out of high school or they're just starting college and they want to start their own business. But there's no funding here. So what would you be your advice? Would you have them partner with somebody else to help them to raise funds, or what would your advice be for them?
The best opportunity, there's some businesses, particularly in the tech startup space, that I'm going to need a team of 20 engineers for 3 years to build anything. And so I need to go and raise $100 billion or whatever. Most of us aren't in those businesses. We're not starting those businesses. Absolutely, you can borrow money, you can get a partner and all of that. But the number one best idea, if you have no money and you have a business idea, is go and talk to your customers, the potential customers. Partly that's research. It's that help. I tell a lot of startups, it's picking up the phone and saying, I would like your help. I'm starting a business. I want to understand my potential clients or what solutions are out there. Can I buy you a coffee? Can we have a half hour Zoom conversation? Can I ask you some questions and get your help? And you'd be amazed how many business leaders will say yes to that question. And when you're talking about your business, most people think of the feedback they're going to get is, oh, that's a good idea or that's a bad idea. There's a third category of feedback you really want, because telling you it's a bad idea is helpful. Hard not to take it personally. It's healthy, you can change it. Telling you it's a good business idea is the worst advice you can get, because you start to believe your own magic. And maybe it's not the real thing you want is someone who says, when is this going to be available? How can I buy it? And so if you've got no money, you've got a good idea, you go out there and talk to your customers and you talk to them about pre-sales, you talk to them about pre-ordering, talk to them about crowdfunding, Kickstarter, some of these potential opportunities. Because if you've got something of value, at the end of the day, business is value. It brings value to the world. That's a core belief of mine. If you have something of value that is going to help somebody else, and the only way you can help them is if they buy it in advance, take a little bit of a risk, maybe get it at a little bit of a discount because of that risk. Mm-hmm. If you can get them doing that, then that's going to give you some of the cash flow even before you have a product in the business. And it's going to give you the validation of the customers. Because if you go to the bank of mum and dad, or you go and talk to a friend who's got a lot of cash and loves the idea, and they go, oh, look, here's $50,000 to go and do whatever. You can spend that money fairly quickly, and it's pretty easy to spend that money without ever actually talking to a customer. That first dollar you get from a customer, you will never forget that moment. You'll never forget that energy. And they know, they're an existing business owner or experienced individual, that if they were the first person to give you some of that money, that you won't forget them either. And the value that you're going to bring to them is going to unfold in enormous ways over the years. So that's where I'd start. It's not the easiest thing to do. It is the easiest way to test whether your idea for business will work. And it can be the easiest way to get some money coming in the doors from day negative one.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. And one more question about that kind of category of person. So people just starting out now, the world is changing, it's remote. And you said you felt like you were successful because you were more of a deep generalist as opposed to just going deep into one category. So what would be your advice? I mean, some people are saying, okay, you should go to college. And other people are saying, you know, college is too expensive now. You shouldn't go to college, even an Ivy League one, because when you come out, you're not going to make as much money as it costs you for school. So what would be your advice on for young people getting ready to be in this market?
The great framework, I suppose, that Scott Adams, the cartoonist who created Dilbert, he's got some great books around life and some controversial books more recently. This is probably going back 15 or 20 years. He said that some people are successful because they are in the top 1% of their field globally. If you're Serena Williams and at 19 somebody says, well, should you practice your tennis a little bit more, or do you want to come and do this course in something? Going and practicing tennis more was absolutely the right thing to do. And I think there are some young people for whom the passion, the drive, the focus is absolutely so. And some of the talent even maybe already manifest. Mm-hmm. If you want to be a heart surgeon, going and you know, skipping college to save on money is not going to live your passion. So there are some people for whom the college option or just pursuing that one passion because they could be the top 1% in the world is an opportunity that they need to choose. The far more successful route, far more common route, certainly my route, Scott talks about, or you could be in the top 25% world and three different skills that somewhat overlap. And he particularly talks about one of those skills being around communication. So for me, way, way back, I was a writer, I was an actor, I talk pretty, and that in my business career has absolutely unfolded. Am I the top 1% of business advisors globally? I doubt it. I think I'm top 25%, absolutely. Am I the top 1%? Probably not. However, am I also in the top 25% when it comes to being articulate on video, being able to write? Well, I probably am as well. Am I the top 25% in some other skills around business, capital raising, culture, some of those kind of things? And, you know, as I approach my 40th birthday, I've had a lot more time to develop those skills. So I've got a lot more of that intersection, that deep generalist approach. So that would be my advice to young people is permission, listen, choose. You have permission to do anything. Listen to your soul. If it says, I just want to do that one thing and I believe I can be best in the world at it, then go and give it a crack. Don't die with that music in you, especially at 19. If you're really not sure, go, well, what are a few of the things that I'm interested in? And what are the ways that I can develop my skills in those areas and maybe find some overlap? And history is replete with innovation that was only created by people who had these disparate interests and these different skills that allowed them to see the intersection of those that created that innovation or that insight. And by telling our kids that you've got to go to college, we really are doing them a disservice and doing ourselves a disservice by shutting down that potential innovation.
Beautiful. I love that answer. Thank you. So just so people can find out how to get a hold of you, why don't you kind of go over what services you're doing now, you know, where they can find your books your channels.
Can get a Googling, as I like to say. That's having done too many videos and articles over the years. My website is jacobaldridge.com. So that's where you can find a whole lot of my ramblings on a whole range of different topics, from travel and family. I had a podcast on IVF from a male perspective. There's a whole lot of things in addition to that business work. And absolutely, if people are in that 10 to 100 employee kind of business, there's a lot there that's specific to those, and I'm always happy to have a chat virtually or face to face if the overlap of our worlds allows it to have a conversation about their business, what they're trying to achieve. Big thing I'm really focused on off the back of Visionary Male Leaders is those speaking opportunities around the world. So if you run events, if you're looking for an interesting topic, get onto Amazon. In your country, we were a number one best-selling book in 3 or 4 different countries around the world, top 20 all over the globe in leadership and in HR and personnel management. So do yourself a favor. It's particularly the Kindle version, ridiculously cheap to get insight from 15 male leaders. So Amazon, Visionary Male Leaders, you'll find the book. Look out for the colorful feathers, which sums us up nicely. And like anything, it's unpacking the conversation, the HTML links. And that's why I love the opportunity to chat with other leaders around the globe, like yourself, Kimberly, is that there'll be somebody who knows and loves you, who gets a little bit of interest in something I've mentioned. They go to my website, there's a link there to somebody else, and then suddenly they're 14 hours into a YouTube marathon watching somebody else. Not quite 63 and a half hours of a YouTube marathon, but still a fairly impressive effort for learning and leading. And that's something that has changed enormously from when I started my career 20 years ago, is that ability to take one person and their relationships and into other relationships and other knowledge. And if I can be part of that journey, that connection, then that makes me a very happy man.
Yes, yes, it's wonderful. And that's kind of how my life is too. I just really value the relationships and getting to know people and getting to know their friends. You gain something when you meet someone and they introduce you to one of their friends.
And as someone who's traveled all around the world, I know the value of that. Landed a new country, you go to a new destination. Any human connection is priceless. And as humans, we tend to have more connections, and we are who we hang with. We hang with people that we like. And so if you find one person you like, chances are their friends are also going to be people you like.
Exactly. So a personal question, what gives you the most happiness and fulfillment in your life at this point?
I remember, it's kids, right? It's maybe a bit of a cliched answer. I remember Paul Graham, who's a venture capitalist, founder of Y Combinator, set up Hacker News, which is a great social media website that I love. And he wrote an article a few years ago around the impact of kids on drive and motivation and vision. And it fits in nicely with that masculine feminine conversation, because he, traditional masculine man, he built, sold a number of businesses, helped a lot of other business owners to do the same in a big Silicon Valley part of the world, before he eventually married his beautiful wife, and who was similarly successful, and they had some kids. And so he had a great perspective, someone who had a whole lot more success than I. And he talked about how it's that drive for contentment that drives all of us. It's the masculine energy, the feminine energy drives that. We're looking for that contentment, and often we feel we're going to achieve that in business. One day, someday, if I have a business worth, sell a business for, then I'll be happy. He said kids just change that perspective, because completely different content. However, you get that moment of contentment multiple times a day, which can be challenging if you're also trying to do that, and that's a juggle that 2.5 years into fatherhood, I certainly haven't mastered. However, I do know that this means a lot more to me than that. Mm-hmm. And the joy of it is that, benefit of today, where I am in the world, I can be having that moment of contentment with a cuddle 30 seconds after we stop the conversation. And it's hard to beat that joy, and having that joy almost when she wants it, almost on tap. So all the other cool stuff I get to do is a whole lot of fun, and I'm privilege, and I've worked hard to achieve that. Nothing beats a cuddle first thing in the morning, last thing at night, or anywhere in between.
That's right. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast today and for sharing all your wisdom. I've so enjoyed it and your insights.
Thank you for some really interesting questions. That was quite a broad range of different things to get me to think about it. And there's a few things there that I haven't had the chance to reflect on in some time. So I greatly appreciate the opportunity and the discussion.
Wonderful. So I have one last question. What is your best advice on living an incredible, amazing life?
I've mentioned it a few times, that permission, listen, choose. And I can't strongly enough say that that permission piece changed my world and is available to anybody. You have my permission. Don't need my permission. If you need an external source at this point, take it. You have your own permission to be and do anything you want, and listen for what it is that you really want to do, and then make a choice, but don't make a choice that rushes you into it. Don't make a choice that if I don't get my whole world changed by tomorrow afternoon, then I'm a failure. In reality, the road is long. The journey is ultimately yours to make in whatever direction that you want. And when you can have that perspective of time and the perspective of do whatever you want, then you can sit in a space of manifesting whatever it might be and doing what you need to do to bridge that gap. And I think whether young, old, business, non-business, there's a lot for all of us to take away from checking in and seeing if we're sitting in that mindset space or if we're holding ourselves back.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Jacob.
Thank you so much.
Yep. And we'll talk to you again soon.